Welcome to The Brains Behind It, the official podcast of BrainHackers.com. The source for smart strategies to improve your life, one brain hack at a time. In this podcast, we talk to the leaders and innovators behind great organizations and find out the secret to their success. Here's your host, editor-in-chief of BrainHackers.com and two-time Guinness record holder for memory, Dave Farrow.
Hey there, brain hackers. We've got a wonderful Brains Behind It here. We're talking about stress and the brain. I've got the expert, Kathy Groover. She's a multiple award-winning author, speaker, just had a TED talk come out. And we're going to be talking to her about stress and the brain and what you can do about it. Hey, Kathy, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me. Appreciate it.
All right, let's jump right into stress and the brain. The site's Brain Hackers. We want to think of different tools and techniques. I'm sure we've heard of things like breathing and things like that, but can you give us a nugget maybe that we haven't heard about stress in the brain?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, one of the new things that I hear so many people talking about, and I mean, I suppose in the science world, it's not new, but the fact that we actually can rewire our brain. You know, we used to think that we couldn't do that, that our brain stopped growing after a certain age, but now
we know. Oh my God, yes.
Neuroplasticity. So we can actually change our thinking, which completely thrills me because I don't want to be stuck in my brain from when I was 12. That's not interesting to me. So I'm thrilled that we can change our brain with our thoughts and with things like breathing and meditation and mindfulness. So much great stuff's happening.
Yeah. And I, you know, when I was doing first, you know, in this business, like 1996, when I launched my course, I would do radio shows and I would talk about how the brain can change. And I actually got like angry emails from people who are scientists. Now, I wouldn't call them scientists. I would say they're neurologists. So they're more like physicians, right? But even the world of neuroscience was fledgling in those days. Neurology was the thing instead of neuroscience, you know, as a science. But anyways, the point was, they were like, this is against the science. We know that the brain is hardwired after a certain age. It never changes. And I would respond back very clearly and politely and says, listen, I have 2000 years of evidence going back to ancient Greece that memory techniques can change the brain, that we can change how we think and we can change our memory. And yes, doing that over and over makes you have a sharper brain your whole life. And we have tons of examples of that. So I think the onus is on them to try to prove this crazy theory that it can't change. And then one day, you know, brain plasticity hits and Lumosity comes out, and that was kind of a piece of crap. Sorry, but you know,
it was fun. I like the games, you know, make it a game and I learned too, you know.
Yeah, it was a fun game, but it was just the science was not quite there and everything. But I think a lot of people were kind of turned off by the whole like brain plasticity debate. And I think we need to reinvigorate it, because there have been some people who took advantage of the brain plasticity, made kind of just games and stuff, and they don't realize that it's more than that. So explain, when it comes to stress, it's more than just playing a game. Like, to get real brain plasticity, we're talking how long do you have to do a habit? How many times, you know, to get a result, to actually get real changes in the brain? Let's be real.
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, well, the experts say it's 21 days to create a new habit, you know, but I look at people's thinking and I hear one of a couple of things. Either it's this consistent negative thing of, I don't have enough, I can't afford that. I mean, they're just reinforcing that thought pattern over and over and over again. It drives me crazy. I'm like, you can change your mind. If nothing else, you have the ability to change your mind. You always have that option. The other thing I hear all the time is, oh, well, it's always been that way. Or, oh, well, that's just David, you know? And it's like, but that can be different too. And just because it's always been that way doesn't mean it has to be that way going forward. So I look to things like affirmations, visualization, meditation, and I teach a simple mini meditation because I'm a little type A. Don't know if you can tell. Raised by my dad, only child, very competitive, control freak, like triple Capricorn. So I'm getting to all sides. Yeah,
I'm a Capricorn myself.
Of course we were. So yeah, very driven. I will get up that damn mountain if I have to climb boulder by boulder, but doesn't really work well for meditation. So especially with men, no offense.
I'm driven to be the best at meditation.
I will relax. You know, I'll put it on the to-do list. Relax today. Yeah. I get it. So I love teaching people meditation in a way that can actually be done. Yeah. I actually show in my PowerPoint slides, I show a cartoon. It's this guy who looks really stressed out. And he says, what is the caption of the cartoon? I'm going to be the best at meditation. I'm going to be the best meditator ever. And you know, it's like this whole very stressed out type type A, I'm going to be the best at relaxing ever, which, as we know, doesn't work. So, but I love those tools.
Yeah, there's actually a great Zen riddle about this. And I really am fascinated because I love history, especially ancient history.
Yes.
Read the Tao, read the Diamond Sutras, mm-hmm. read Zen philosophy, Jainism, Ifa in Africa. Anybody look that up and things like that. There's a great Zen parable where the idea is that the student goes up to the master and says, well, how long will it take me to master Zen? And the master says 10 years, something like that, right? And he goes, okay, well, what if I practice every day and I sacrifice everything and I work at it really, really hard? How long will it take then? And he went, 20 years, right? And that was the thing that confused the student. But the whole idea is that Zen is the harder you try, the longer it'll take. It's right. The opposite. It's letting go, not embracing. It's very, very hard for a Western mindset to get.
Yeah, and especially us type A driven people, because to us, the harder you work, the more ahead you'll get. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that friction of that hard work, that heat actually doesn't work. So I've learned that too. I've learned that surrender. I was going through a transition phase a couple of years ago, and I do not transit well. I'd rather be going. And they said, well, you know, you're just going to have to float for a while. And I said, I don't float. I swim or I get out of the pool. Like, I don't want to float. That's not my thing. And they said, you just have to float. And I realized that's true. It's like, you can swim against the current, or you can just let go and say, okay, carry me wherever you're going to take me. And so that relinquishing control was a huge thing for me a couple of years ago.
Well, what about habits? Like, let's say you are a type A personality. Like, sometimes if you don't write things down, they won't get done. So I had a lot of negative programming when I was a kid. You know, my parents, I love them, but they said a lot of negative things about themselves and dumped that on me. And I had to kind of change that mindset if I wanted to be successful, because I was literally in the middle of getting tremendous opportunities and I was sabotaging it. I knew it. I was screwing it up. I was not making a call. I was showing up late for things that I really cared about. I was getting huge depressed and not able to leave the bed, like things like that I knew were 100% my fault. The world is bringing an opportunity to my door, and I failed to grasp, and I really struggled with that for like 10 years. And that's when I got into Buddhism and meditation, all that. But one of the things that really helped was simply having a mantra, having something positive that you know that you say, but you do it even if you feel like crap, even if you know you shouldn't, you know what I mean? Like, you kind of force yourself to do it every day. And then, like you said, that 21 days, the 21 day theory of developing a habit actually comes from a NASA study. So it's very, very well based on stuff. So you know, you do that for 21 days. I would even say like a month or two, and then it becomes easier. Your subconscious is doing it for you, you know? So what do you think about, you know, taking your conscious will and just like kind of creating a daily routine or a daily habit, something like that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And when I work with clients with affirmations, because I'm also a hypnotherapist, so I do a lot of work with affirmations and setting those anchors of what do we want to change, you know, getting into that subconscious and changing that programming, changing those knowns and those unknowns. So what you have to do is convince the subconscious that this new thing is a known. And when we've been beaten down our entire lives from negative words from our parents or influence from other kids or whatever it is, that becomes a known to us. So we have to change that.
When you say knowns and unknowns, is it kind of like, are you talking about like the bullshit meter? Like your brain thinks, you know, I can say something positive, but my brain's like, oh no, that's bullshit. Like, and you have to say it often enough before it feels like it's true, or what?
Yes. Yes. And in the subconscious, we have these no. So we know that if that dog run towards me, it's going to bite me, because that's what happened when we were a kid. Our logical mind goes, it's not the same dog. Not every dog is going to bite you, but somewhere deep in our subconscious, we still believe, no, it's going to come at me. You know, I know adults who are still terrified to walk past a house that has a dog in the yard. You know, that's a known to them that is now not true. So how do we change that? You can't just convince yourself otherwise. Look at people who smoke, who they know they want to quit, but they just can't.
Right. So there's a known, like, I know I'm lazy. I know I don't follow through. I know that I'm not that smart. I know all these things. That's the kind of thing you're talking about. You pick one of those and just kind of whittle it down with something positive until it goes away.
Exactly. And then shift that thinking. And one of the best ways to get straight into the subconscious is hypnosis. But when working with the hypnosis, I typically send people off with affirmations. I have them write them longhand right before they go to sleep. It's that last half hour that we're vulnerable to getting things directly into the subconscious. And for some reason, writing things out in cursive gets in there deeper, it gets in there quicker.
When some people hear about hypnosis, they think, oh, this is like BS or like, you know, kind of crazy snake oil and everything. But you have a PhD in this. So explain some of your, you have a PhD. Explain some of your background and why you're an expert at this.
Well, I've been doing hypnosis for about 5 years. It's a newer modality for me. I started out as a massage therapist and then moved into the mind-body medicine stuff and got the PhD. And I've studied a bunch of times at Harvard with like the masters of mind-body medicine.
So you got so your PhD is in mind-body medicine?
My PhD is in natural health with an emphasis in mind-body medicine.
That's brilliant.
And then
that's great.
Because I'm obsessed with learning, any place I can go find out more, I do. Because I'm obsessed with it. And the more I know, the more I can help people. So that's the thing too. But I've always loved hypnosis. I've done creative visualization and visualization work since I was in high school. And so there's a school here in California called HMI. And I thought, you know what, I want to add this to my practice. And so I started studying it. And, you know, there's two ways of doing the hypnosis or hypnotism. There's the stage hypnotism, which I'm not a huge fan of. Yeah, it's funny. Oh, look, everyone thinks they're on a roller coaster. Oh, it's really cold.
That's
now.
What everyone thinks of with hypnosis. Yeah.
Right. Or they think of the movie Get Out, where you're going to drop into the floor and lose control of yourself. That can't happen. That cannot happen. You're not going to do anything under hypnosis you wouldn't do regularly. So all those people up on stage acting like fools, they'd act like fools anyway.
Well, I mean, you can kind of say that about being drunk too, but people still do things. Like it gets rid of their inhibitions, but they still do things that they maybe regret later. Like they're not necessarily something they wouldn't do, but...
Well, I don't know. I don't think that's a good comparison. I've seen people
be
blackout drunk and not even know what they're doing. So
that's a good point.
Yeah, I mean, that's probably not the best.
Mildly inebriated, maybe, you know.
Yeah, a little tipsy. You know, it does take down those inhibitions, but it's also about having fun and, relinquishing that control. When I have people in my office to do, and I'm not a clinical hypnotherapist, but to do clinical work, you know, we look at really specific objectives, we look at what the root cause is, and then we draw, you know, go into that subconscious and again, help change those knowns and those unknowns. So we make it known now, you're a non-smoker. You know, and I've worked with, I don't do a lot of smoking, it's not my thing, but the two clients that I've worked with smoking, one session, they're done. I've gotten people on planes who were terrified of being on planes. I got a woman driving around the country who could not drive 15 miles away from her house without a full-blown panic attack. She called it sheer terror. I don't even know that I've ever experienced sheer terror. But to her, driving in her car 15 miles away from her house was sheer terror. And in one session, I had her driving around the country. So I've seen really, really amazing results.
Just one session. That's pretty impressive.
One session.
All right. So are some people more likely to be hypnotized than others, though? Like, does it work differently on different people?
I have to do it differently with different people. So everybody can be hypnotized. For the longest time, we thought, no, that's not true. Some people, over-analytical people, they used to think we're not able to be hypnotized.
I've had a lot of difficulty being hypnotized. I've done self-regression, visualization, things like that. But having somebody else hypnotize me, I've tried, and it's been very difficult. Yeah.
Well, but it also depends on how you define hypnosis, because most of us are walking around hypnotized all the time. I mean, 60% of us are kind of, you know, the movie Shaun of the Dead.
Yeah, we're all zombies. Yeah, that's fair.
We pretty much are. And if you've ever been driving in your car and you've suddenly gone, oh, did I pass my exit? Where the heck am I? I don't recognize that tree. You basically hypnotized yourself. Or if you're reading, and I've had this happen to you, you're reading, you turn the page, you're reading, and you realize, I haven't been reading, my eyes are moving and I'm thinking about something else. You've hypnotized yourself.
I am notorious for that. Yeah. I'm thinking of all the different projects and designing and different things in my head.
And this is what slot machines do too. The flashing lights, the sounds, that repetitive motion, you're basically hypnotized. This is why people can sit there all day and not move away from that slot machine. So hypnosis is a natural state for us. It feels really good. And because of movies like that and all the President's Men and, you know, movies like that where you think you can actually be brainwashed and completely lose yourself. And these stage shows that you saw, you know, at the frat party, people believe that hypnosis is BS. And I got to say, I've seen some amazing work with it. Amazing.
Or they're afraid of it. Like they're afraid to let go and all that. Yeah.
Yeah. What if I tell you something? What if I do something stupid? One, you're not. You're not going to give me your PIN number. You're not going to be a chicken. You're not going to run through the streets. You're not going to do any of that. Nor would someone who's a professional hypnotherapist tell you to do that, you know. And if you're picked to do the stage show, say no. You don't have to get up on stage. And they do really specific tests to see who they want to get up on stage.
Oh, yeah,
they
of course.
people that we call who are very suggestible called.
I'm never picked. I want to be, but I'm never. I actually know
so
because in the memory guy, I actually know a lot of like mentalists, and they tell me they would never pick me. Not in a million years.
Oh, no, no. Yeah. It's actually a blast. I was actually picked once, and for part of it, I'm like, okay, I'm just going to play along with this, which on one hand is hypnosis, because you're playing along with it, you know. You're
Yeah, people don't understand that actually is a suggestible state. If you're playing along with it, that you're actually in a suggestible state. You're not in the typical, I guess, skeptical state you're in. Like people who are watching the show, they might think, oh, yeah, that thing she said, that makes sense. That other thing I disagree with, like you're making decisions. And when you get like deeper into hypnosis, into that hypnotic state, you're in that suggestible state, which means you've given the benefit of the doubt. And sometimes that is like a level.
Right. And I've seen stage hypnotist shows because I go to a hypno conference every year in Vegas, and this
of course
will be like my
do.
Third or fourth year. Yeah. It's so much fun. I mean, bowling night and pool party and sleepover. Oh, we have a blast. Anyway, I'm giving away too much of behind the scenes.
I don't want to know about a hypnotherapist conference sleepover.
Sleepover?
That's the one that was too far. But no, go ahead.
I thought like police officers could party. Holy crap. You don't want a room of drunk hypnotherapists. It's amazing. Yeah, so we have the alcohol and the hypnosis. But no, they do a stage show every year, and I have seen countless stage shows, and I've seen some where, you know, you get 10 people on stage and there are one or two who they're just not in. They're not playing along, they're not. And finally, a good hypnotist would say, "Why don't you go back to your seat? This isn't a good fit right now." You know.
Or they don't say good fit. They put it in part of the show and says, "Yes, you can go. You can go. You will stay."
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
So, but it works. I mean, it's got really great clinical and therapeutic benefits.
Right. So you'd really recommend that for anybody who's dealing with panic at all to at least try that out.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if we're talking like panic, where you're medicated, where you're working with a psychiatrist, you want to get doctors, like I would get a doctor's note for that. The woman who I work with for the driving, I was more working with her for the driving. I wasn't working with her for like any kind of mental illness. Things, it ended up being linked to smoking, which was, it took me forever to figure this out. It was a long, complicated thing. But yeah, got her driving. So fears, mild, like test anxiety, public speaking, smoking, weight loss, that's huge.
Okay. Do you ever get to the core of these things? Because I've heard people say, oh, yeah, I do one or two sessions of hypnosis and I get a result. And it seems like you're treating the symptom, but, aren't they smoking for a reason? Don't they have anxiety or maybe there's trauma or something? Is it really, do they really deal with it in such a short time?
Absolutely. And that's what we do. I mean, because what people say, I've had people walk in the room and they start to tell me their story. And then after about 10 minutes, they go, oh, well, you know, we should do the hypnosis. I'm like, no, it's an hour session. And literally the first half hour or 35 minutes is the talking. Mm-hmm. We're trying to get to that root problem. And in the smoking, we look to see, you know, is this truly a chemical addiction? And I have to say, in most cases, it's not. It's just a habit, which is why you can sleep all night and not have to wake up for a cigarette, why you can take the 12-hour flight and not have to have a cigarette. It's not a chemical at that point. It's just the habit of doing it. So what
depends on the person. I guess there are some people who, I know some people wake up instantly and need a cigarette and coffee.
Yep, absolutely. Or we had people who woke up in the middle of the night and would smoke in bed because that's so safe and healthy.
Never been a fire from that.
No, never a problem. So sometimes it's a chemical thing, but oftentimes it's just a habit, and they do that at certain times. I do it when I drive, I do it after I drink, So we do get to the root of that. How long have you smoked? Why did you start? Can you picture that first cigarette you had? And, you know, we actually take them back to that first cigarette.
Wow.
How did that feel? What is that? Oh, it's an awesome system. But yeah, no, I've had great success with it.
All right. So what would you say to somebody who, maybe like, isn't quite ready to take a hypnosis session, but they want to do some sort of self-hypnosis thing. Can you give us an example of like a do-it-yourself at home thing, like a brain hack for right now, something they do? When do you do this? Is this something you should do before bed, or is it something first thing in the morning, like when you're wide awake? Should you like make sure you're not tired or what?
To do like self-hypnosis? Well, self-hypnosis kind of has to be guided. You know, you want to get online or find some guided meditation, guided visualization. It's all kind of the same. If you're being guided through a visualization, it's pretty much the same as hypnosis. You can't have hypnosis without visualization and vice versa.
Is it any different from a meditative state? Like if you really get into meditative state?
There are different levels of hypnosis. You can go really, really deep where you do kind of have a little bit of amnesia. That's hard to get to and not everyone can get there. And you don't normally need to. I mean, that's kind of, you know, everybody thinks that's the gold standard, but really you can get work done with them remembering what you're saying to them, you know, just like anything else. But let me teach you. Can I teach you my mini meditation?
Oh, yes, yes, please, okay, please, cool. Please. Yeah.
All right. So it's really simple. And you're just concentrating on your breath, the rise and fall of your chest. And on the inhale, you think, I am. And on the exhale, you think, at peace. And you just repeat that over and over again. It's so simple. And you act, that's actually changing your brain. It's actually, we call it the mini meditation because you could do it for 30 seconds. You could do it for 5 minutes. You don't have to close your eyes, especially if you're driving. Creates a whole other set of problems. But I do it all the time.
Meditate while you're driving, kind of.
Yeah. Well, you can, just don't close your eyes. But what I've started to do, because I'm a little impatient, again, surprise. So when I drive, especially in Santa Barbara, everyone's just too slow. And it drives me crazy when, you know, the guy in front of me slams on his brakes at the yellow light when I thought I was going to get to go too. And they frown on you getting out of your car and moving the guy. So I take my hands off the steering wheel. I think, inhale, I am, exhale, at peace. And I do that until the light changes. And it's saved me. So, because why am I going to put myself into that stress state over something that stupid?
Of course. That's the Buddhists would say that you're exercising patience, and that throughout life, at different times, we have opportunities to exercise patience. This actually reminds me of Thich Nhat Hanh. He's if anybody who's listening right now, if you're interested in meditation, check out his books. He's like this amazing Buddhist priest, and you know, his whole thing is if everybody could breathe in, I forget the whole thing, but like breathe in light and breathe out peace or something like that. So like kind of think one thought when you're breathing in, think peace when you're breathing out, then the whole world would be different, you know, simple things like that. And it's, but it's actually much deeper than that. He's got books and philosophy and everything.
I got to study with him at Harvard.
Really?
He was amazing. And it's so funny because he actually admitted that he had days where he couldn't meditate because his brain was too busy. And I'm thinking, your job is to meditate. Like, that's your one job.
You had one job.
Sit there and meditate. But it was so encouraging because, oh my God, if he has days where it's hard, then I can give myself a break. You know, I can give myself a break if I have trouble sitting still for a second, you know. So it was so inspiring that he actually shared that with us. He was incredible.
Well, that's like the age old you know, zen parable about the student who goes up to the master again, and the master is crying because the master lost his wife, and the student goes up to him and says, but you teach us that all physical possessions, indeed all relationships, are just an illusion. You know, don't you know that the relationship you had with her is just an illusion, and we're all, you know, part of this great energy? And you know, the master, you know, was crying the whole time and says, yes, but she was the most beautiful illusion I've ever seen. You know, and it just shows, I know, get the feels. But it just shows that even this great master is like, we're all human. And that's why, you know, like I got into memory techniques because I had ADD, you know, like everybody who you see has achieved this amazing thing. You know, you think they were born with it. More often than not, they were the one who was struggling with that. The person who is the priest is the person who is worried about their faith and struggled with it. That's why they delved into their faith, you know, that sort of thing. So just like you know, you teach meditation, you teach, you know, this anxiety stuff, and you get frustrated when you're at a red light and everything, and that's perfectly normal and human. Right. But if you didn't do that, could you really relate to the people that you teach, right? And if I didn't have memory problems at some point in my life, could I really relate to the people that I teach, right?
Right, sure. Well, and I see so many people, and that's why they chose their career. You know, how many people struggled with mental illness who now went in to be social workers and psychologists, or addiction? Or, you know, I have clients who they want to go to be a physical therapist or a massage therapist because of what myself and some sports medicine people have been able to do for them. Mm-hmm. I lost my mom young. She died when I was 18 of really horrible cancer. Mm-hmm. And so that was one of the things that propelled me into doing healing work. It wasn't as clear as, oh, she died, so now I want to go do this, but it was that giving people options. Right. She had no options. It was Pittsburgh in the 80s, chemo, surgery, radiation, didn't work. These days there'd be so many other choices for her, but you know, I want to give people options. And if it's not meditation mm-hmm. for you, maybe it's mindfulness or maybe it's breath work. And there's mm-hmm. countless ways to do breath work, you know, to me. And this is why I keep studying. And this is why I get so excited about this stuff, because there's always an option. And if nothing else, you can change your thinking.
Yeah. There's actually somebody in Canada and it also relates to the States as well, in psychology, but there's this one, I can't remember her name right off the top of my head, but I was sending out an email. My team sent out an email to try to get her to be interviewed. But she was in a mental institution for years for bipolar disorder. And then one day she had an epiphany and said, you know what, I'm going to get out of here. I'm going to get my PhD. I'm going to become a clinical psychologist, and then I'm going to change this system, because the way patients are treated in the system is absolutely terrible. And she did like a TED talk. She did all that. She's been revolutionizing the whole system. Based around trauma and things like that, rather than some of the arcane, you know, ways they were looking at it. But the funny thing is, she said back then she didn't tell anybody who was analyzing her that was her goal, because they'd think that she has a delusion, you know? So she set a goal, but she had to pretend, like, because everybody would think, oh yeah, you're not going to get a PhD because of how the doctor saw the patient. They sure. really saw the patients as lesser beings. That was really the thing. They didn't see them as equals who are struggling with a disease. They saw them as lesser beings. So they couldn't possibly imagine that a patient would get a PhD and then teach them about psychology, right. you know? But that's exactly what happened.
Well, and also we tend to see people's limitations. We are so eager to share our negativity, to share our, oh, I tried that, that won't work. I mean, I had the privilege to travel to the Middle East to do some speaking, and I spent some time in Jordan, and I went to Egypt all by myself, which freaked out a lot of people. And it was, they were so quick to say, you're going to get beheaded. I had one client start to get so rude. He said, oh, well, you know, if you could refer me to another massage therapist, because you're not going to come home alive. Call me when they need it, you know. And I finally looked at I said, will you shut the F up? Which I don't normally talk to my clients that way, but it's like, dude, why are you talking to me like that? Like, why would you try to program? And it comes from their own fear. So we allow our fear to limit others and vice versa.
Well, I want to say that that's very brave of you. That's very, very cool, because I mean, I would agree with you that the don't believe the hype, don't believe the propaganda, especially if somebody works in the media. Yeah. You know, these countries are filled with, they're just people just like us. And that we, the horrible things make it. I'll tell you something funny that might make you laugh is I have probably 10 friends from Canada. I live in Canada. I work in the States. I cross the border daily for a commute. And you would too, if your money was worth 30% more when you cross back. I'm just saying.
Sure. Yeah. No, I'm good.
anyways, I have at least 10 Canadian friends that will not come to the States with me because of, they hear about mass shootings, they hear about crime, they hear about, and they are terrified to go into America from Canada.
God,
you know,
that's hilarious.
I know it's hilarious from our perspective, but I'm telling you, when you're in another country looking at the media, you only see the negative. That's the only thing that comes in. I can kind of understand it, because when I'm there, it's the only thing they see about America is, like,
of course,
you know, what's Trump doing and who got shot today, and that's it, you know.
Yeah,
usually in that order if it's CNN.
Stop tweeting. But I agree. No, and that's true. And this was around the same time that, unfortunately, that poor girl was like set on fire in Syria or something. Oh, she was there as a, and I bumped into a client like 2 days before I was leaving. I was going to Jordan and Egypt. Okay. Mm-hmm. 2 days before I was leaving, I bumped into a client at the post office, and she said, oh, did you see what happened? And I'm thinking, oh, great, now what happened? You know, and she goes, and I said, no, what happened? Thinking something happened in Cairo or something happened in Jordan. And she goes, that girl in Syria. And I said, oh, well, yeah. Well, are you still going to go? And I said, I'm not going to Syria. That's like saying, did you hear about the shooting in Chicago? Are you still going to New York? It's two different places. You know, but also we're geographically challenged. I'm geographically challenged. Mm-hmm. But also we hear, you know, I was so brainwashed by everybody feeding me this negative stuff that as I flew into the airport in Jordan, I was looking out of the plane and expecting to see bombs going off in the distance. Like I expected to be flying into Saving Private Ryan. That's the I had in my head from the news, from the input, from all these people who were trying to scare the crap out of me. It was one of the best trips ever. I had a blast. The most amazing people, gorgeous country, killer food.
Yeah.
That's all I have to say.
And, yeah. And yeah, and it's beautiful. And the thing is, you know, you have to be able to separate the propaganda from the reality, you know. It's amazing how people talk about, like, the school shootings and things like that, but nobody's talking about what's going on in Chicago, right?
Right.
And so the media has a lens. You've got to use your own brain to look through that to find what the truth really is. All this good stuff can be looked up. I'm not going to, you know, go over any of the political stuff, but sure. it is important. Actually, it actually kind of fits with our discussion here. It's not even a tangent, because it really, it's part of that whole thing about how we're always under a state of hypnosis. We're always, and I would say the state of hypnosis is, if I could sum it up, it'd be something along the lines of suspending your critical thinking and making kind of a shortcut judgment or shortcut idea, like you're not thinking through all the details. So in some ways, you know, that can be very helpful to clear your mind of all the sure. details, lower anxiety, things like that. But the zombie world that we live in, where we're just going to work, coming home, and we're watching the news and everything, if that's all that you see, you only see the right. propaganda, you don't see the actual facts, you're not digging deeper, you're not thinking for yourself, so you're basically kind of massaged by the media to think a certain yeah. way. And it's a tragedy. It's so interesting when people actually, there's a whole bunch of things like this, like that when people actually see the scientific studies on this that contradict the narrative, it makes your head explode, you know?
Yeah.
And they don't know what to think, you know?
Well, it's about shifting mindset. And the downside of this media is it plays on fears. And it's igniting people's fears. Mm-hmm. And, you know, part of the job of our brain is to protect us. We have a quicker response to a negative valence than we do a positive one. We're wired that way to survive. Mm-hmm. So when you're constantly being bombarded in this kind of hypnotic state, because you're staring at the TV and the lights are flashing and it's all quick, these quick cuts now, mm-hmm. and you're exhausted from your day and you've got your glass of wine or your joint, whatever.
And you also have your guards down. You have no reason to disbelieve what's on TV, even though
absolutely.
I'm amazed by some of the stories that are contrary to facts on the right and the left, I'll say. I'm not going to
sure.
be partisan
and,
about
and
it.
And that people are just, like you said, so blindly buying that. Mm-hmm. So it plays into this fear, and we go, oh, what if that happens to me? You know, I have had clients tell me, oh, yeah, they're going to come take my savings account. They're going to come take my investments, because that's what the government does now. And I'm like, they're not going to do – who told you that? And they'll, you know, do some very radical radio show host whose name I'm not going to mention. And I go, maybe you want to stop listening to that, because they're not telling you the truth. Yes, they are. And you can't argue. I mean, there's no – you can't have a rational –
Well, I would say all of it, even the most extreme stuff, they're saying some truth, and then there's some exaggeration, and you've got to do research to know for sure. You know, I even remember, you know, when I would look at some documentaries, and I'd be like, oh, that's amazing. I wonder if that's true. And I do a little fact check, you know, and that scene from that documentary completely fabricated, but the scene next to it was completely true and everything.
Yeah.
And we think it's all true. Actually, I'll say one of the ones that I, without getting partisan, actually, one of the ones that changed my life, I was vegetarian for about 22 years. And I turned vegetarian when I was 14 because I read some books. And I didn't know any other vegetarians. I just learned how to cook and figured it out myself and everything. And my parents were not on my side. I had to kind of like figure it out. But it was really important for me because it got rid of me eating a lot of deep fried food, got rid of me eating a lot of crap food and everything, and actually cooking for myself. So it got very healthy as a result, but I didn't have to be vegetarian. I'll say that looking back, I could have just started eating healthy, but I thought it was vegetarian. So anyways, as I got older, I realized that a lot of the stuff that a lot of the so-called science that I based my vegetarianism had been completely debunked, and even debunked by the time back when I was 14, completely lies, but it's still being broadcast as truth. And there's one actually on Forks Over Knives, one of the most popular documentaries on vegetarianism that is completely a lie. If anybody researches this, and I will say exactly what it is, if somebody wants to research it, and contact me, I'll give you all the citations. It's very simple. It's called the lipid theory. There was one doctor in the 70s who believed that eating red meat leads to heart disease. It clogs up your arteries, leads to heart disease. We know for a fact that is not the case.
Right.
Even his own data, he was taking data from World War II when they were rationing meat, and he was saying, hey, as people start eating more meat in these countries, so the heart disease started to get worse. What he didn't do is show you the eight other countries where the opposite was true, and he was just making it up. Got on the cover of Time magazine. This was national. This was the consensus, the scientific consensus for probably 40 years. The American Heart Association, the government. it led to corn subsidies, wheat subsidies, all these different things, and it's based on a complete lie that's still being propagated today.
There
is no link between heart disease and eating meat. Look it up. There's also no link between eating cholesterol and cholesterol in your blood. We know for a fact you can eat a ton of cholesterol in your blood, eat a ton of dietary cholesterol, and you won't raise cholesterol in your blood, and vice versa. You can eat none, and your body will produce cholesterol. Your body produces it. It doesn't get it from your diet. And we've known that for at least 25 years. But the average person
doesn't support their narrative.
Exactly. And it doesn't kind of support what you want to believe to be true. So they edited it. I was just amazed by that because I want to know what's true. I'm not trying to prove a point. I wanted to get healthy, you know?
Yeah.
I still eat a lot of healthy food. I'm not like a meatitarian, but I have some meat in my diet and it's not the end of the world. I'm actually much healthier for it, you know?
Yeah. My dad's in the hospital right now after a heart attack. And so they not only changed all of his meds, which I think was a really stupid choice. Like, why would you change 6 components out of 8? Because now he's starting to have weird reactions and they don't know what it is. What a surprise. Right. But they said they put him on the heart healthy diet. And I'm thinking, okay. So I arrive, here comes his heart healthy diet. There's margarine, artificial sweetener, and it's all carbs. They give him freaking macaroni and cheese. Yeah. And I'm like, how is that heart healthy? And he's a type 2 diabetic. So here, why don't we give the overweight guy with the cardiac problem and the type 2 diabetic
high glycemic
a bunch of cheese on pasta with artificial sweetener and margarine. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, oh my God, it's not 1973. What are you guys doing? Eat real food. Yeah. And I'm, they wouldn't give him any meat. And I'm like, Dad, you're not getting any protein, So I appreciate that he's following orders. Unfortunately, the orders are wrong.
Yeah.
And I don't know how to build that in people. You know, I've read so many books. I've done so much research, the whole cholesterol thing and forks over knives. I'm totally with you on that. That movie drove me crazy. But how do we start to shift that thinking in a mass amount of people who are just programmed to follow instructions? I don't know.
Well, I think a lot of people on the left believe that there is fake news on the right. A lot of people on the right believe there's fake news on the left. But they don't admit that there is fake news on their own side. I think that's the thing, you know? So I think what we have to do is realize that a lot of it's real, a lot of it's fake, and you need to look it up to find for sure what the answer is. And there are, you can look this up. PubMed is a public resource. Anybody can look up studies. You don't need me to do it. You can even Google these things. There's a lot of well-cited, blogs and things like that. But maybe, they don't like the truth because so I always question, are you trying to find the answer? Like this goes into the mass hypnosis idea because propaganda is a mass hypnosis tool, And this really kind of goes into our psychology and our mindset that we as human beings, we're afraid of not knowing the future, not knowing what's around the bend. We're afraid of these things. So it's more comfortable for us to believe a convenient lie that we have all agreed upon. If all your friends say something is true, some politically or economically or scientifically, you believe it to be true, whether or not it's been proven. And then when you encounter evidence that supports it, you weigh that higher than evidence that goes against it. And this even happens in the scientific community. That's why there's peer review. But I think that, I think because of technology and social media, this has been just amped up. And you have these whole groups of people who are 100% this is true, and the other people are 100% that's wrong, and they're clashing in a huge way. But I think eventually we're going to get a society. I'd like to think we're going to get a society that Rubin Report actually is a good example. He said that eventually this will lead to a large middle on the political spectrum that is more conscientious and logical, and actually just researches and looks things up. You know.
I hope so. It's starting
to happen. We have 48% of people in a recent survey do not identify with either Democrat or Republican. It's the largest political voting bloc is nonpartisan right now. It's first time in human history or American history that has happened, you know? I think it's starting to happen.
Good. Yay. You know?
Let's talk about this, about as a hypnosis expert. We didn't intend to get into this track, but it actually does fit with what we're talking about, the sort of mass hypnosis thing. What do you think about things like sports being the opiate of the masses and entertainment and media and things like that. What do you think about mass hypnosis? Are we all under a spell of some sort, and how can we break free from it?
Yeah, I think it is. I think there's something about this tribal mentality. You know, I'm a huge football fan. I love the Pittsburgh Steelers. I will sit there and cry during football games, and I'm flinging my terrible towel to the detriment of my husband's eye 1 year, which I never did apologize for, but he was sitting too close. It's not my fault. But I think there's, you know, there's the individual and there's tribe and there's that sense of community and that sense of nation. And I think that's one of the things that drive us as humans. We are pack animals. And so I think it's kind of good that we can all come together and cheer at a concert or yell for the Super Bowl or the World Cup or whatever it is. I think that brings us all together. And I think one of the things that is changing the world is things like the Olympics and all of these world games. I think that's a good thing. It brings us closer together as a tribe. The problem is when we get tribal and we look to other tribes as bad. You know, there are football teams that I cannot stand. Now, I don't hate the people that like those teams. I just don't like those teams. And I think people can take it further. And because different is scary and other is scary or offensive or whatever it is, you can disagree with someone's politics. You can disagree with someone's football. But the problem comes when you hate that person and you start to dehumanize them and you look at them as their idea and not as another human being. So I think that's really one of the dangerous things is when we get so upset at someone's thoughts and their actions that we demonize them and we take the humanity out of them.
Yeah.
That's how we can have all these wars and all these prejudice and, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. So, all right. So there's actually a neuroscience principle about this, about shortcuts. Essentially, if I were to make an algorithm that was programming what emotions actually are, they're usually a logical, they start with a logical base. You know, I care about something. So you take everything in the universe and assign it a value. So this is a coffee cup. It has no value to me. This is like a sentimental thing. And maybe when I was five, that has value. This is a picture of my son. This, of course, is even more value. So, you know, we have to assign value. Some things make us feel good. Some things make us feel bad. But it's because at some point we made some sort of logical connection or decision, and but the emotion is that shortcut. It's like I don't have to go through all the logical reasons why I love my son or I love, you know, coffee or something. I just feel a certain way about it. So it's actually a shortcut. And I think that's like the basis of how we're living in this hypnotic state all the time is we're making shortcuts about everything. I don't need to think about someone else's political beliefs. Because I thought about it once when I was in my 20s, I made a decision or somebody told me, and I just made this shortcut. Now I just feel a certain way. And it's really hard for people to go back and say, maybe my feelings are wrong. Maybe the decision I made back then is wrong, and I got to examine my prejudice.
Right, right. Well, and we have to remember feelings aren't facts. Those emotions that we're hit with aren't facts. Me getting so upset with a guy on the freeway, that's not a fact. He's not an evil person. He wasn't probably doing something on purpose. He was either unconscious, he was in a rush, he had a bad day. We've all done that. We've all been on both ends of that exchange. So we have to remember that just because we feel something, not that you don't, I mean, not talking about loving your son and yourself like that, but these transient feelings that come through, we have to remember not to act on every feeling we have. We have to stop and then think about that feeling. And that's where that pause comes in. And that's where that responding rather than reacting comes in, which is huge. And that's one of the things that all of this helps you do. The breath work, the meditation, the mindfulness, the hypnosis, it helps you pause and not punch out the guy on the freeway that cut in front of you. You know, it doesn't warrant, that's not fight or flight worthy. You know, if he's assaulting you in an alley, by all means, kick his butt. He just cut you off. It's not that big a deal, you know, and we get wrapped up in these feelings, forgetting that they're not real.
That's very true. That's very true. Well, I want to thank you very much for being on the show. You're definitely a brain behind it, Kathy. Why don't you tell people how they can get a hold of you?
Yeah, absolutely. The best way is my website, which is kathygroover.com. You can find out about my speaking. I've got videos up there, my TEDx trapeze videos. I'm a trapeze artist as well. And all of my books are there. I've got 7 books. It's kathygroover.com. I'm all over social media, LinkedIn, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, whatever is coming in the future. I'm sure I'll be there too.
All right. I think there's some really, really good nuggets, really good information. I hope the people watching and listening really enjoyed it. And I look forward to seeing what your next adventure is going to be. Thanks very much for being on the show.
Oh, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to The Brains Behind It. And remember to check out brainhackers.com for more. If you have a suggestion for the next interview or comment, please email editor@brainhackers.com. If you want a free 30-minute marketing consultation from Dave Farrow and his team, then email editor@brainhackers.com.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.